Hi there, people. His name is Mark.
And his name is Mark.
I'm getting tired of you getting the first billing all the time. Is it just because you're taller?
Yes.
Oh, but I'm older. Where's the respect, youngster?
What?
Wrong.
You're wrong.
So what we do, I guess you guys know what we do because we better... How many of you have heard us do this before?
Yeah, so we must have done okay if you're back.
I told you we needed new questions. All right, we got new questions. Basically, I take the IT pro point of view, and we have the god of Azure over here, Azure CTO Marcus. And he's going to answer my questions sometimes. You guys are here, though, to keep him honest, because if it seems like he's sleazing out, I just want to go, hum-bub. Just you know, start the rhubarb. Let me ask you guys some questions first. How involved in the cloud are you? The easiest one. How many of you have an Office 365 account? I guessed 90%, Mark. What do you see? Keep your hands up.
Yeah.
Something like that? Okay, that's the easiest way to get into the cloud, you know? And that's SaaS, right? Software as a service. It's important. If you're going to do cloud, you got to know your asses, right? So SaaS. And then the other one, I think the second biggest is going to be IaaS. What is that? Infrastructure as a service, where you run virtual machines in the cloud. How many of you have an Azure virtual machine? I guessed 40%, Mark, right? I think it's about that. It's about maybe 50. That's amazing. This must be a Microsoft crowd. Here was the tough one, though. The third kind, what's the other as? How many of you know your as's? Okay. What as am I missing so far? PaaS, platform as a service. Azure, somebody came up to me early this morning and said, can you tell me what Azure is? So just in case you're one of those people, Azure is the generic word for all of Microsoft's cloud services. PaaS, platform as a service, is pretty exciting stuff. We're going to talk about it later. But the short version is you build an application that can only live in the cloud, essentially. So that's interesting stuff. Azure, what are these people called? Azure Cloud Services or something like that?
What? Well, cloud services have a special meaning in Azure.
Right. I'm saying in the Azure world, a cloud service is a PaaS app, right?
It's a PaaS compute app. But PaaS includes anything that you consume as basically a REST endpoint. And it's a multi-tenant deployment behind it where you don't worry about infrastructure maintenance and patching the thing and security, and we take care of that for you.
So when you said compute, give me an example of a thing that's not compute.
Azure Database.
Oh, okay.
Azure Storage. Those are PaaSes.
Oh, or like Data Lake or something like that?
Data Lake too, yeah.
Okay, there we go, all right. So how many of you have an Azure PaaS of some kind? And I had guessed 10%. I think I was almost right. More 5%, something like that. Okay, well, good. So it's been a while since we've done this. A good 14 months, which in cloud time is about a century. So I have to keep my notes about what I'm going to ask him here, otherwise we'll be here for 3 hours. So now, those are big numbers. I mean, the fact you got that many people in IaaS and PaaS, you know?
Yeah.
What's the kind of growth that you see? I saw some numbers from you guys about 6 months ago that your PaaS was actually growing way faster than you expected.
Yeah.
Is this the growth you expected? If I'd said to you 14 months ago, this crowd is going to be 90% O365, 40 to 50% IaaS, 5% cloud services.
So I would have to say, yes, I expected that.
Oh, you expected that?
That's why I went and started to work on Azure, because I expected this kind of growth. Now, there's other people that maybe didn't expect this kind of growth. We can talk about that later.
Yes, as an economist, it's called the dismal science. I'm an economist. What do you expect from me, buddy, you know? So when do you think it plateaus?
I don't see any end in sight. So we've been...
Oh, spare me the marketing hoo-ha.
No, I don't. If you actually... I mean, marketing boom or whatever. You know that the IT business right now is people use whatever various numbers to estimate the size of this IT spend on services and infrastructure, and it's between $1 trillion and $3 trillion a year, depending on who you talk to. So right now, cloud is a tiny fraction of that. So this is why Satya will even say this is a $1 trillion total addressable market potentially here.
Oh, okay, that makes sense, because when I was putting together a talk I do about cloud, then the first question is always, how big's the cloud? So how did I get that number? Well, how would you try to figure out how big the cloud is? You would. Really? You're not aware that there's an internet and you could Google it, right? Bing it.
With Bing. Google it with Bing.
So Microsoft. Okay, that's right. You'd Bing it, and when you can't get the answer, then you Google it. Okay, so is it?
It's the last time.
Is it really true that Bing stands for because it's not Google?
God. Do you have any new jokes?
As long as they keep laughing, I'm going to use that. You know that Bing joke?
Don't encourage this kind of crap.
You can use that anywhere. Absolutely anywhere. No, seriously, if I Googled it to see how big the cloud business was, I saw numbers as small.
Because everything on the internet is true.
Oh, no, it gets better. The smallest number I saw was $2 billion. The largest was $150 billion. So apparently all you need in order to be a predictor is a website. And one has to expect when you see a range like that, there's a certain amount of numerological proctology going on. So my guess, about $16 billion. All right, so you believe that that makes sense. Yeah. If the cloud is somewhere in the $10 billion range now, which is, you know, 10 to $30 billion range, then there's a tremendous amount of growth.
Yeah, excellent. And we've publicly talked about this, Satya, in our last earnings, and even a year ago, doubled in compute capacity over those two periods. So 100% growth.
So you...
Year over year.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I know you can't say these numbers, but as I go around the world and I'm listening, I happen to be in the same show as Microsoft people doing these sessions, I hear some interesting numbers. That there's something on the order of 10 million email domains in Office 365, something like 750 million Office 365 accounts, those are Azure AD, and that sometime this year, I heard, you guys have a millionth machine in the data center. If that's the case, that means you're buying a million servers this year. Time to buy some HP stock.
So I will say that number is not that. Stat right there isn't accurate about crossing the million machine mark. I won't say it.
Okay.
It's inaccurate. I can't talk about how many we have, but
I didn't think you would.
But it's on the order of millions.
Well, there's a Microsoft guy in another country that keeps saying a million, so you
but he can say whatever he wants. No, actually he can't say whatever he wants to, but what's his name?
I don't recall. I can't burn my sources. When you guys were designing Azure, I don't know, you started with 100 machines to test it or something along those lines. Were there points where you said, oh, crap, you know, once we get to 10,000, we got to do something different?
Yeah, in fact, we've had multiple oh, craps.
Oh, really?
Got to do something different. In fact, we're sitting here looking at the kind of growth that we have, doubling year over year for the foreseeable future, and going, I mean, anybody here has built a system where you double it in capacity and demand, you've got to probably go back and re-architect it, and when you're going... We see line of sight to going up another order of magnitude on top of that. We need to start planning ahead for that kind of system. So it's a constant re-architecture that we're undergoing.
And I imagine you guys have learned some pretty amazing stuff about managing somewhere in the neighborhood of a million machines.
Yeah, actually you learn a lot of lessons running and deploying that kind of number of machines. And actually when you talk about doubling in capacity year over year, you get really good at turning servers on.
I think I have an idea for next Ignite's for a talk for you to do. So along those lines then, I have to ask the question, and I'm going to ask this every time because the cloud business changes so much, it's reasonable to ask it every year. I'm an IT pro. When I had a DNS problem because I was being overloaded, I went to Amazon because they had Route 53. It was easy. It's $3 a month. That's great. That's very, very specific though. There's few things as simple as a DNS zone. Mm-hmm. When I wanted email, I went to Microsoft. And when I did move my web server into the cloud, I did you guys. But why make that choice? If someone else here is anyone here thinking about taking a virtual machine or a physical server and putting it in somebody's cloud? Is anybody thinking about that right now? All right. All these nice people, why would they choose you guys and not whoever the other guys are?
Well, so I talked to a lot of customers that come to campus. So it's a little bit of a self-selection bias with the customers that I do talk to, of course. But the first entry point to them talking to me about Azure is almost always, hey, we just signed O365, 50,000 seats, 20,000 seats, 10,000 seats. Now we're talking about going to the cloud for our workloads and our applications, a lot of times surrounding O365. And naturally, we're going to talk to you about Azure first because we've already done this deep analysis of how Microsoft operates SaaS, and we already have this enterprise relationship with Microsoft. We already understand what your support processes are. We already understand what your regulatory and compliance and global build-out looks like for O365. So the way that I call it, and this is not politically correct, O365 is the gateway drug to Azure.
There you go. Didn't get as many laughs as I thought you would for that one. So let me ask the question a different way.
I didn't really answer your question.
Oh, well, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, so that's what starts them on the discussion. And then, of course, we talk about how we believe that we've got a differentiated offering. Of course, let me ask a question. How many of you believe that you're going to have a multi-cloud strategy? We're going to say some workloads go to this cloud, some workloads go to this public cloud. And I want to do that because I want to hedge my bets. One of them screws up. I know that I can go and I've got expertise on the other one. How many people are in that category? And how many people are in the, you know what, I'm going to pick a cloud and I'm going all in because if I've done the evaluation and I'm onboarding the complexity of using a particular cloud, I want to simplify my life and just take that big bet. So I'm seeing...
Can I add one?
Yeah, go ahead.
And how many are choosing a cloud but saying, you know, I like those guys, but I don't trust them as much as might need to, and so you're going hybrid. For how many of you is hybrid a very important thing? Not nearly as many hands as I expected. That's very interesting.
Well, I've seen a trend, again, through the self-selection of the customers that I talked to, which it started out as always, we're going multi-cloud, and we like you guys, but you might screw it up, and we want to be able to pull out if we need to, and so we need expertise on the other side. And, of course, there's some organizations that feel compelled to not pick a winner and to go to both, you know, especially governments. But more and more I'm seeing companies just say, I realize it's going to make my life so much easier if I just go big on one. And if I do the due diligence and I understand the processes and billing model and customer support and compliance and regulatory requirements and geo build out, and I think that that's when more and more I'm seeing that trend. And for that, O365 really is part of the Microsoft cloud. It's not like you're picking O365 and then you're picking Azure, which is something completely different. We've got a unified vision, which is Azure Active Directory is a pillar of our cloud. O365 is the major SaaS platform. Dynamics 365 is another one that connects nicely to O365. And then Azure is the substrate under both of those. So when you pick O365 and you say, oh, I've got these certifications that I need, my business needs for handling of data, and it needs to be in this particular region, you're picking a stack that includes Azure. So from a Microsoft perspective, this is one cloud. When we go into a region, we go in with that full stack of software and all those services together. And so this kind of makes it easy where you get data gravity around these kinds of applications. You're not worried about how to bifurcate your data and your workloads into two different places, or worried about compliance and regulations and support for one that works in one way for one app and works a different way for your cloud applications over here that you've got hosted in a different place.
And I imagine that it has occurred to you guys that at some point, if you have enough billions of Azure Active Directory accounts out there, you guys become the identity. You're the single sign-on for the web. And at that point, the power is...
Yeah, well, I mean, that is one of the cool things about AAD is that you can use it no matter what you're signing on to. Whether you're signing on to your own on-prem stuff, signing on to Azure or O365, or even third-party SaaS and PaaS. In fact, you can use it to sign on to AWS if you want to. But it's... Like, I think if you take a look at how enterprises built up their corporate networks, identity is like one of the first questions you got to answer. How am I going to manage identity?
It's dial tone.
Yep. It is dial tone. And so you make that bet, and you need that single source of understanding who's part of your network and what they have access to. Because you don't got an employee that leaves the company, you need to be able to shut off their access to whatever they had access to immediately. And you've got policies in place for how they interact with your systems and services and data. So AAD is, I think, going to be a center of gravity. It's built on top of O365, which is now, as probably everybody's heard multiple times at this conference, the largest SaaS application on the planet.
And jumping off what Mark just said, because I'm an AAD guy, I happen to know this, is that the notion that once you sign on with your AAD account, they have this gallery. It's the single sign-on gallery. And when last I checked, there's 400 different SaaSes that you can get to. So you log on with your Azure AD account. By the way, even if you don't have Office 365, you can set up an Azure AD domain for nothing and then jump off to SaaS.
And I think actually the number of total connectors we have out in the gallery is on the order of around 3,000 at this point.
Is it 3,000? Okay. Yeah.
And it,
I looked at it 3 months ago, so
It has really cool capabilities. Like one of them that I talk to customers that they get really excited about is Twitter. So you've got a social media director that has access to a Twitter account today. They leave the company and they're pissed off because they got fired, and now they're like tweeting crap in your Twitter feed that's embarrassing to the company. So just as one representative example of how AED can give you a single point of control, the Twitter connector manages the Twitter credential on your behalf, so the end users never see it, and they sign on to Twitter using their AED credentials, their corporate credentials. The second they leave the company, you shut that off, and now they don't have access to the Twitter account anymore.
Well, that's great. But one thing I wonder about when you talk about why Microsoft has an advantage in one way or another is I wonder how long it'll last. To put my economist hat on again, the cloud is clearly an oligopoly kind of world. It's a small number of large players. I guessed that back in 2008. That didn't take a lot of brains. Turned out to be right. But if you look at things that are other oligopolies, oil, airlines, they're commodities. I don't say, oh, I got to go to an Exxon station because it's better than that Amoco gas. You know, and if I fly Delta, it's only because I get goodies if I do a lot of miles with them. The seats in United are just as uncomfortable as they are in Delta. Yeah. Anyone here from Delta? No? Well, let's talk about them. But anyway, so in the same way, I asked you about, and I wish I could understand how you manage a million machines. That's insanely great. You guys are going to come up with an answer to pull one out of the air. Amazon's going to have to come up with that answer. Isn't there really only one best answer? Won't you all converge to be doing almost the same thing? Won't there, at some point, certainly a mailbox is a commodity now, right? That's a great example. But maybe compute in 5 years or 10 years. Is it possible that we will converge to a small number of folks essentially doing the same thing because it's the best thing? It's the optimal thing. Is that possible?
Well, first I thought you were going to go in a different direction, which is how many will there be and why? Why aren't there going to be a dozen different clouds, public clouds, that are all like the airlines or the gas stations competing with each other? I think it boils down to one key answer, and that's ecosystem. That is, the partners and ISVs, developer expertise and operational expertise that was required to go and put a business on top of a public cloud, it's expensive to build that up. And it's very similar to the what we saw in the mobile space. We had two ecosystems build up, and when you talk about the app gap that Windows Phone had, which was we don't have apps. Why don't we have apps? Because we don't have customers. Why don't we have customers? Because we don't have apps. And so you get no ecosystem flywheel going there. And I see the same thing playing out in the public cloud. Just from a perspective of Azure and our efforts to go and get partners and ISVs and get training materials out there so that companies don't have to go, hey, we want to use Azure, but we can't find anybody that understands how to use it, so we'd rather go to AWS, where we'd see people that know how to use that thing. So fundamentally, I think that we've got a system here that is going to support two stable ecosystems in much the same way we saw in mobile. So that's where I thought you were going, but where we are going to end up in 5 to 10 years, I think with a couple of big ecosystems, of course, there's this third one, wild card, which is Google, which potentially could be the Windows Phone of the cloud.
Hey, dude, could you stop picking on Windows Phone just for a minute? You know, there are a few of us. How many Windows Phone users we got out there? Oh-ho, see? Look at that. Market share is creeping up on other. So. Okay, let's...
go ahead. Yeah, but what the question you asked was,
sure.
You know, 5, 10 years, isn't it going to be all the same thing? Isn't it commodity?
Commodity like, compute
like,
or something.
You know, Android, iOS, it's the same thing, big deal. I just pick one, my personal preference. It's hard for me to say, but I do think that the choices that companies are making now are largely going to determine over the next few years where the bulk of the business is with one cloud or another. And so this is why you see us being very aggressive about trying to get, you know, when you're going to make your pick, because once you're in, you know, you could talk about operational portability, you know, on these containers, and so that way I can move to wherever I want to. But you don't, what is very difficult to get is data portability. Once you've got a mass of data sitting in a certain place, like extracting that out and moving it someplace else is massively expensive and very complicated. And so this is why you see, you know, where people put their data, that's where their center of gravity is going to be. And it's important for us to make sure that we're the best place for you to have your center of gravity.
That sounds good. Let's go to the as-is. Okay, so we've kind of done sassy stuff just a little bit. So I told you that I have a story. I don't know if I told you the whole story, but I have been running a web server since like 95. It's been various kinds of machines and various operating systems. The 2003 one, you guys stopped supporting for some, well, not you, but you know, Microsoft. My problem was that I was running on server 2003. It was a steam-driven machine, and you can't get coal for it anymore, so I was forced to upgrade to 2012 R2. And when I did that, I'd heard that if I built a Hyper-V virtual machine, that I could easily move it into Azure. So I thought I'd give that a try. And I was running it for a couple of years, but it was time to leave where I was and didn't want to have a business internet account anymore. So I did a lift and shift up to the cloud. Anybody done that, where you've taken a physical or a virtual machine and moved it up to Azure or something like that?
So a few people.
So the rest of you, a lot of you said you were doing virtual machines, but you just built them in the cloud fresh. You didn't first have them on premise and then move them up. That's interesting. Anyway, so in the process, I did this, I guess, last December. And I'm reading blogs about it, because there's lots of blogs on how to do it, and they all have the same banner on the top that said, by the way, there's two kinds, there's ASM and ARM. ARM's coming soon, it's much better, but we're not going to tell you how to do that. So I said, okay, I guess I'll do ASM. And so I did that, and as soon as, and it works great. By the way, at this point, it cost me $70 a month, which is like twice what the electricity used to be, just to run my web server, performance is good, all that kind of stuff. But I'm a little worried that I've got ASM-type virtual machines. And I know you thought this was a boring question, but you know, I'll bet there's a lot of people out here that have this question. So if we're IT pros and we've done an ASM, the new one is ARM. What does ARM give us? What are we missing?
Well, you ask how many people know what the heck we're talking about here?
Okay, so I guess, sure. So many of you said you have virtual machines in Azure. Did I get that right? Yes? Okay. Did you build them before last December? How many of you have machines, virtual machines built? Okay. Those guys are under ASM, which is the Azure
Service Manager.
Service Manager, thank you. And then sometime around, what, March-ish?
Well, 2 years ago, we released the preview, and then about a year and a half ago, it's hard for me to keep track of all
these things.
We GA'd Azure Resource Manager.
Okay. But I think if you were following the blogs to do it, there weren't a lot of blogs to do it yet. So I'm going to guess there's a lot of ASM. I mean, when you look, how do you know? I mean, I know mine's an ASM, but if I looked at somebody else's virtual machine in the Azure portal, would they? Oh, I guess it's a. Is there an ASM and an ARM section?
Yeah, you can see those virtual machines.
I mean, does it differentiate which or which?
I believe so.
Okay.
I've not used an ASM virtual machine in a while, so. Yeah, it does. Actually, it does. I mean, for sure it does. What you will see is that it's got different capabilities than the ARM virtual machines.
Okay. So I guess that's my question. I'm an ASM virtual machine. What am I losing by not converting to ARM?
Well, so first, I will tell you that we understand the enterprise, and one of the strong guarantees that we've got, one of the commitments that we have to the enterprise is as long as you're using something, we're not going to abandon it, at least not without getting your buy-off and giving you a path forward onto the new thing. In the case of ASM, our commitment is that we're not going to abandon ASM until we see the last customer say, I don't need this anymore. Of course, we can help encourage you to move off. That will make both of our lives easier. But our commitment is that it's not just like we're going to, next year shut it off and say, have a nice day. That said, if you've got a virtual machine running and it's an ASM and you're happy with what you get there, then you can continue. There's hard to convince you to switch that virtual machine to ARM. You're not going to get a lot of benefit out of it if it's just going to sit there and run forever. If you're going to create new...
I'm sorry, let me make sure I understood that. You're saying if I've just got a virtual machine running, like my web server runs 24/7, and it has to be ASM, are you saying I wouldn't get much from going to ARM, or that maybe I would get some things, or
You wouldn't get them a whole lot.
I wouldn't.
I mean,
okay.
Yeah.
What am I missing? Can you enumerate anything? Or?
Well, so if you take a look at Azure... There's a bug up here. Pull the Obama fly.
I'm waiting for the Twitter photo. It looks like we're punching each other.
So Azure Resource Manager is the new control plane to Azure. And so when we, as many cases, you build a system V1 and you learn a lot in the process. And one of the things we learned is that we had all these different services and there was different APIs and formats and different ways to authenticate to the different services, different ways to model them. And you couldn't create a holistic cloud application that consisted of objects from like a database and a website and a virtual machine. And more and more, you just don't create a virtual machine. You're using other resources as part of a larger application. So it's important to us to make a model where you could approach all these things with one common interface that would support being able to identify those resources, to be able to lock those down from a permissions perspective with role-based access control to the control plane, to be able to put in management policies on them for who can do what and what to different resources under what circumstances, and also that we could have a way for this new world of declarative application modeling. So if one of the things that you realize is as you move to a world of automation and a world of lots of different applications is that you can't sit there and write scripts to stand something up, let it sit there for years, and then forget, you know, how the thing is configured and never be able to create the thing again. The world is one where you define the structure of your application in a declarative way, you hand it to a system, and then it goes and automates the provisioning and management and lifecycle of those resources. And so that's what ARM is really fundamentally going after, this notion of templates, where you can define that website plus the database plus the VM in a single template. Now you take that template and you can reuse it all over the place. So for one of the examples of multiple environments where you want to take the application and put it up more than once is dev, test, and production. So you take the same template, put it in your dev test environment. Now you have something that looks exactly like what you'd have in production, except with configuration that's test configuration. Make sure it works, take that same template, put it in production with the production configuration, which includes things like production access, access to production key vault versus the dev test key vault for secrets in it. And then that also unlocks this ecosystem where you've already probably seen in the Azure gallery, in the Azure marketplace, everything you deploy from there is built on Azure Resource Manager templates. And we're just at the start of this, building up this ecosystem where ISVs and SI, systems integrators, and you yourselves as delivering services to your organizations can go create templates. In fact, we've got IT, I can't remember what we call it, but already in Azure, you can go at a tenant level. So if your organization has an AD tenant, provision templates there and give access to your users to those templates. So you can say, this is our best practice template for virtual machine plus database. Yep. We're configured the right way with the right virtual networks, and here you go. If you want to deploy that, take that template and go. And so that is, I think, just in a nutshell, at the high level, the value of ARM.
So in my case, because I'm just doing IIS website, my SQL services are just...
Yeah, you stand up a singleton VM, you're just going to let it run forever. Okay. No.
Great. So I don't have to worry too much about going to it, but if I wanted to, is it possible? I mean, basically a VM is a bunch of VHDs. Could I bust it up, take the VHDs that were in it, sew one back together and have an ARM inside of an hour or something like that?
Yep, exactly. That's exactly what you can do is take that virtual machine's disk, image it, and then create, or you actually just take the disk and then launch an ARM VM off that. So it's actually pretty straightforward. Now, the places where companies run into complexity, and I'd like to see a raise of hands for how many companies, people are from companies that have this complexity of, I've got a whole bunch of applications that are ASM applications and they had ASM networking and now I want to migrate that to ARM and have it interact with my ARM stuff. How do I manage that kind of complexity? And that's where some of the features that we've lit up, like VNet peering, which we just announced here at Ignite, really helped that transition of ASM to ARM. And we've had some customers already down this journey, large ones like Accenture, that had hundreds and hundreds of ASM deployments that they've now successfully, and they announced that this week, migrated to ARM.
Very good. Now, So to summarize, if I'm ASM, I could probably be happy to stay there, okay? If I do want to move, again, as I said, you bust out the VHDs, you rebuild the network. Even better, you got the VNet peering, which sounds like I've got this VNet for my ASM, I'm building some ARM, and I've got there, and
They can talk to each other. Yeah.
That's exciting, because that's one of the weirdest things.
Without a gateway in the middle, you used to have to put a gateway.
Somewhere. Exactly. Yeah. That to me is, I'm a little slow, is that with any kind of cloud service, I'm just used to plugging in networks, and they just work, right? Because we're plugging in switches and that sort of thing. And the cloud version of it is just, there's nothing wrong with it, but it takes some getting used to.
Yeah. You know?
Interesting. Then the declarative stuff sounds interesting because that tracks on the PowerShell side desired state configuration.
It does. And actually, yeah, they go hand in hand. So I've worked closely with Jeffrey on DSE and driving some requirements from Azure, because what we'd like to see is ARM as the declarative model for the, you know, as the outside shell. Once you get into a virtual machine, DSC as our model for configuration inside of a virtual machine. And now that it's on Linux, it can serve as common configuration for whether you're doing Linux or Windows. Of course, we embrace open source and third parties, and so Chef or Puppet or whatever else you want to use, Salt or Ansible or whatever else, is of course something that we also support. But from the way that we deliver configuration, of course we're gonna use our DSC.
Yep, but if someone's gonna take a Hyper-V virtual machine and move it to Azure, speaking of support, I gotta ask you two questions. Originally, I built mine with a VHDX because everybody was saying, that's the hot one, that's the cool one.
You wouldn't ask me the question.
Well, I just want to save these people the trouble, that's all. And I went to upload it, and Azure's like, oh, we don't do no X. No, we just do VHD. is that temporary? I mean, now, honestly, I don't know, it may be from your point of view, because you guys are running the cloud, what in a data center we'd see a benefit of VHDX, maybe it doesn't make any sense for you guys.
Well, let me ask, how many people wish that Azure supported VHDX? Let's see, raise of hands. All right, so almost nobody, so I'm just... No, the answer is, of
course... You really are a Microsoft employee. This is about your 10th anniversary there, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
It is?
Yes. I've been fully assimilated at this point.
I guess so.
No, the answer is, of course, it's inevitably going to come. VHDX is coming.
Okay.
One of our fundamental requirements to VHDX and Gen 2 virtual machine support is getting 2016. We wanted to finish that rollout first, and so that is
Sorry, you said it really quickly.
Yep.
Gen 2 is bad also? So I cannot upload a Gen 2?
That's correct. Sorry, today is Gen 1 VHD.
Is there any UFI support in virtual machine?
No, not yet.
Oh, okay. All right.
So that's one thing that we're definitely working on. I can't give you timelines on it, but you know, it's one of those, I mean, you saw the raise of hands, and actually there was a good number of raise of hands, but we haven't, we've been getting a constant customer, hey, we want to use VHDX because that's what we're using on-prem, so for the hybrid scenario of moving things back and forth, that would make our lives easier. So we hear it loudly and clearly. It is a matter of prioritization, and we're getting to it. Like I said, our first step before this is getting 2016 rolled out in our infrastructure.
Great, great. I only underscored the Gen 2 because it's easy to move from VHDX to VHD. Unfortunately, it seems to be impossible to go from Gen 2 to Gen 1. I'm sure there must be a way to do it, but nobody seems to know. So, all right, so that's IaaS. Let's go to PaaS.
Okay.
Interesting story there, because when Azure first came out, that was its job. I mean, forget virtual machines, forget mail. It was a cloud platform, Azure Cloud Services. And I used that phrase a couple of days with you and said, oh, that's been deprecated. Now, you talked to us in Chicago about what containers were, so I don't want you to recapitulate that.
Yeah.
But when you talked to us in Chicago, you were kind of saying what a container was. It really hadn't been implemented yet. I think you just announced it that day or something like that. So where do we go? We went from, there's a thing called Docker, there's a thing called containers. And let me just do the Mark dummy version, okay?
Yeah.
Is that it's a way of packaging up an application so that you almost literally are copying a folder over to IIS or a cloud or something along those lines.
Yep.
And the kind of
that's pretty good.
Well, thank you. Yeah. For an IT pro.
It only took 10 times of me explaining it to you to get to that.
I'm a little slow. I went to a state school. what do you want from me? But I think the bigger story there is the story where the containers help with is that you have a developer go out and build something for you. And the developer builds this, and it compiles just fine on the developer's machine. The developer knows that this is a perfect application and that no one could build a better application. Just ask him. And hands over some files to you, the IT pro, you stick that on the server. Server's maybe a different version of the operating system. It may be more secure. You might not have .NET 4.5 sitting on the server and nothing works. So the developer says, well, you broke my great application. Here, let me sit down at your server as an administrator. And you need this, you need this, you need this, you need this, and it's great. Anybody ever had that happen? Is this? Yeah, okay. And then, if you didn't actually have a video camera that was recording it, you could never reproduce that ever again. So now you have, what is it you and Snover say? Cattle and pets, right? Now you have a pet server. It's fluffy. It sits in the corner, and if it dies, it's a terrible, terrible thing. It's got a name, exactly. That's right. You know, when it dies, you have a funeral, you know, with the cattle. When it dies, you have a barbecue, right? So, so to get away from that, I'm told that if you can build something into a container, It really is as simple as just dropping it, yeah. You know, on IaaS, private cloud, whatever the heck it is. Originally, it was Linux stuff. What you guys have done in the last year is that you made Windows supported as well. So, A, you're supporting Linux containers. Mm-hmm. B, you're supporting Windows containers. And then containers have a kind of soft virtualization that they do. But you've got, what you've added to that is Hyper-V virtualization, which probably isn't necessary, but some people want to have it because they feel more secure. Mm-hmm. Okay, so new platform. This is replacing cloud services. I mean, bridge the gap for me, because cloud services basically was, correct me if I'm wrong, you're essentially building something like an ASP.NET application that's a little different and it sits on Azure.
Yeah.
How does that look different now?
Well, I mean, so
first IT pros, yeah. What are we going to see different?
Well, so the cloud service was really aimed at, the cloud service model aimed not at IT pros, but at developers.
Absolutely.
And so containers are this fundamental building block that can be something that IT pros use directly, and I'll explain that in a second, or that developers typically indirectly use. And whereas cloud services, like I said, is clearly aimed directly at developers, whereas IaaS was, again, one of those object types, those containers that could be used by IT pros directly. IT pros could go install and stuff in there, or developers could go create things that would go deploy into those IaaS VMs.
Can I pause you for just a second?
Yeah.
Can you have an entire app in a container? Or containers like Legos, and you need 50 of them to build them?
You can. So this is kind of one of the misconceptions, I think, because when people talk about containers, they emphasize the benefits you get in the kind of extreme pure world, which is I put single components inside of a container, and my larger application consists of many of them. This is where you hear the term microservices come into play. And so now they're all in their discrete containers. They can't interfere with each other. They work reliably, and I can scale them independently. And I've got different developer teams that are updating each of these parts of my application independently. But fundamentally, as an object, as you know, a directory, as you talked about it, you can put whatever you want in there. And that thing can be consume as much CPU and RAM and storage as it needs to. So when you think of containers as being these small things, that's kind of the extreme case of really microservices that are very lightweight, have very low resource requirements. But you can put SQL Server inside of a container now. In fact, we've shown SQL Server on Linux inside of a Docker container. That doesn't mean that SQL Server is a small SQL, managing a small SQL database. It could be managing, sitting on a Linux server with a terabyte of RAM and multiple terabytes of storage behind it, but sitting there still packaged up as a container and operating in a container on the Linux server.
Okay, so help us play developer for just a moment. Yeah. Let's say I'm going to build an HR app. It's, you know, what we used to call them, N-tier apps. I'm going to need a web interface. Okay, so I'm going to need a web server in there. I'm going to need something for my business logic. That's probably just going to be some C# code or something along those lines, maybe not. I'm going to store it in a SQL database because it's crazy to do anything else at this point. Would I go out and find that there's a container that's got access to a SQL database? That's one Lego.
Yeah.
There's another one that puts JavaScript on my screen when I, you know, I builds me web pages and stuff like that. I don't know what the BI chunk would look like. Something C#-y or... And then, so when I open up Visual Studio, I've got a library of these things, mm-hmm. and I say, okay, connect the SQL here, great. It's an object, it's got a magic name. I can say things like write records, read records, things like that, delete records. And then for the other thing, there's something webby where we'll say, this is the text I want you to give these people in this font. It converts it into those web pages. Is that something along those lines?
It is absolutely along those lines. And actually, there's a nice parallel between what happened with virtualization and containerization, in that the topology described in the early days before there was virtualization, you'd have to put that front end on its own servers, put the middle tier on its own servers, and put the whatever other components you talked about on their own servers. With virtualization, that allowed you to actually go consolidate those different components and put them on a smaller number of servers. In the same way, that application you just talked about, now you put it in containers, and if its resource requirements are or less than a server, you can actually go put those things into virtual machines and pack them really densely and put multiple of these things. It's really like nesting of objects, physical server on the outside, virtual machine, at least when you're talking about public cloud. There is the next level of the nesting and then containers inside of that. And the benefits you get at each level are kind of from one level to the other one is exactly the same. It took you a lot less time to create a virtual machine than it took you to go provision a physical server. And it takes you, again, that same reduction of orders of magnitude to go create a, spin up a container as it did to go create a virtual machine. And so it's kind of the next step in this evolution of how to get things to be faster and more efficient.
And I guess you could say, when we started going virtualization, what was the story beforehand? It's 1999, we have racks and racks and racks of machines that only do one thing because Windows can't do two things, and they're all running at 5% CPU capacity, which is terrible. We do virtualization, that's great, but we've still got these SCSI servers 3 feet away on these little cables. And then around 04, 05, 06, we virtualized the storage as well. Because, I mean, the situation in 98, 99 was you had a server very tied to specific hardware. So even taking an image and trying to, was a nightmare. The great thing about virtualization was that it hardware neutered us. And the great thing about SANS was that it hardware neutered physical storage. And you're saying that to a large extent, I think I've got this right, that these software components are the same way because it's back to more cattle, fewer pets.
Exactly.
Now, can you give, maybe you may not know this number. If you were to count the number of IaaS virtual machines you have versus the number of PaaS applications, I'm guessing that the IaaS is way bigger than the PaaS. Is that correct?
That is correct, but...
at this moment, you know.
When it comes to cloud services, kind of that kind of PaaS versus... Well, I think it's tough to draw comparisons for a couple reasons. One is that we've got cloud services, of course. We've kind of signaled that, hey, the next step in this evolution is virtual machine scale sets with a true microservices containerization platform, which our first party offering a service fabric. We've got third parties that we've partnered with to have those as services on Azure, including Mesosphere with Mesos DCOS and Docker with Swarm. But so when you talk about how, you know, from our perspective, those look like virtual machines, but they're really PaaS running on top of them. Same thing with Azure App Service, which is websites and logic apps and API apps. Those are PaaS too. Those are all sitting running on top of virtual machines. And so when you talk from an Azure infrastructure perspective, it's all virtual machines. You go have to go one level in. In some cases, we don't have visibility really into what people are doing on top of this stuff because you can bring your own container orchestration system. You can bring Cloud Foundry, for example, and deploy that into virtual machines. And now you've got your own PaaS sitting on top of our IaaS. So when we'd view it as IaaS, you'd view it as PaaS, for example.
So can I ask, how many of you are thinking now, currently planning to, or planning to plan, to build a PaaS application, something in Azure, something on Beanstalk, or something like that? How many of you are thinking about that right now? So let me ask a big question. Not many of you, that's interesting. If I realize we probably don't have a lot of devs in the room, but the benefits to doing it are insane when they actually work. I mean, it's just very, very cool stuff. I want to talk about something that I hear all the time, which is that, you know, putting a virtual machine into the cloud is a great idea, saves me a lot of money, I love it, and a VM's a VM. If I had to move it from Azure to AWS, I could do it within X hours. Okay. Cloud services could do some great things for me. I always say that people come to the cloud for the wrong reason. I put together a cloud keynote back in 2008. I did it for a number of years. And then in 2015, another client said to me, hey, Mark, we're tired of that one. Do a new one. And so I said, well, you know, at the beginning, I said, I guessed this stuff back in 2008, which is pretty good for an economist because, you know, we've predicted 9 out of the last 2 recoveries. And so that was a joke. And so, but I missed a few things. And the one was you guys went to the cloud faster than I thought because I forgot. You know, my think of the conversation was that some people are worried about security and stuff like that, but the big boss is saying, all my golf buddies are in the cloud and saving so much money on IT that if we don't do this, we're going to be the most secure company that's no longer in the industry, you know? But the problem with cloud services in some people's minds is lock-in. If I upload a virtual machine, I'm just moving disks around. But if I build an Azure app, I can't go move that someplace else. And so a lot of people fear PaaS for lock-in. Do you hear that? What do you think about that? I mean, do you have advice for people about that?
I heard that a lot a few years ago. I'm hearing it less and less today. And I think it's worth exploring what vendor lock-in is and what you get from trying to stay removed from the platform so that you supposedly have independence of vendor lock-in. One of the things that I have heard some customers say is the way that I'm going to avoid vendor lock-in is I'm going to containers and I'm going to something like Cloud Foundry or Mesos or Kubernetes, and now I can take my applications and move them from wherever I want to wherever I want. But I think that that is ignoring a huge amount of the operationalization of the application, the securing of the application, the interfacing with the networking services of the cloud, the identity aspects of the cloud, the data gravity you're going to end up with those applications that are sitting inside of a particular cloud. And so I've actually talked to a major company that is sitting on a public cloud that was saying, from the start, we're going to stay vendor neutral, so we don't have lock-in. We're going to just use the basic IaaS APIs. We're not going to use any of the higher-level PaaS services so that we stay independent. Well, they ended up maturing their service over a few years, and then they sat down and said, you know what, we see that potentially we could save money by going to a different cloud, or at least we're big enough now that we can start to use pricing as a negotiating factor, and if we need to, you know, have some credible story that, hey, if you don't give us good pricing, we're going to just expand over here in this other cloud. And when they sat down to look at what it would cost them to move, they realized, wow, you know what? We thought we were not locked into this, but all our operating systems, all our processes, all our tooling, all our monitoring and diagnostics and security systems and evaluation, and it is all built around everything in this cloud. And just that is the lock-in that we've got right there. Sure, the application itself is just in IaaS VMs, but everything around it is this giant complexity that is going to make us... And they didn't even have a data gravity problem. They had data that was pretty portable.
So I never heard about containers before about a year ago, and now they're the flavor of the month. I don't know how to ask this intelligently, so I'm just going to ask it straight out. Aren't containers just another fad? I fear that if I built something with containers and in 2 years, like, oh, no, containers, you got to use bottles now. Bottles are better or something along those lines.
I don't see that what the next thing is other than layers on top of containers. And I think one of the things you hear is serverless computing. That's the hot buzzword that's showing up now. And it was kind of led with Amazon AWS Lambda, which is considered serverless computing. Developers just write a snippet of code and they submit it and they put rules around when that code executes. And you get a bill for only as much resources that code consumed while it was actually executing. So it's a fantastic model that really simplifies and gets rid of all the complexity of sizing my virtual machines and paying for stuff when I'm not using it. And how do I set up the logic to when this thing gets activated because I want to shut it down when it's not active. And so this model is, of course, we've got something that we believe is superior to AWS Lambda in the form of Azure Functions, this serverless model, kind of the same programming paradigm and the same billing model if you want it. That is kind of where developers will go with this, but you still need these basic constructs, this how you package the code, how you operate it on the infrastructure underneath it, and that is containers. And so just like you can abstract a virtual machine away from a developer, like you do with our PaaS services today, you can, you know, these containers underneath are also abstracted away. But, you know, what's the next unit of composition that's smaller than a container where you say, oh, I've got this piece of code that is so tiny and it runs for such a short period of time that a container is actually a heavyweight thing for it? I haven't seen the need for that come yet, but, you know, maybe it's going to come at some point in the future.
How quickly do container apps, I realize it's a big span, but I mean, if you build some basic container app, are we talking milliseconds to start it, microseconds, seconds?
Yeah, so that's actually a loaded question, too, because the answer is it depends.
No, I understand that.
It depends on the app. Just like how long does it take, you know, VM to spin up? Well, the VM itself, the container itself, so when we measure in the Windows Server space and performance optimization for containers, we measure different scenarios, different types of containers starting up. What would it take for a .NET Core Hello World app to start up, what it would take for command.exe to start up in a container. And so that, just like on the Linux world, you're talking in the order of seconds or sub-seconds. Okay. So it's somewhere in that range, you know, in the seconds range. When you start to talk about, you know, SQL starting up or something like that, or a .ASP.NET app full-blown starting up, then you're paying a higher cost in just the application's startup, which is on top of that container.
Good, good. Let's move to another one. Yeah. One of the things we talk about is sometimes Azure has little hiccups, and all cloud services do, but you're the Azure guy, so I heard about a little hiccup you had this year where you ran out of storage in one of the areas. Was that really true? Like, they're down to the last byte? It's like... Okay, so I have heard from people in the in the Australia area that there was a problem with storage where you guys ran out of disks. I imagine the Azure guys like run out to Best Buy. What's the biggest disks you got? We need them all.
No, we only asked our developers to go to the Best Buy back when I started in Azure to buy servers. No, so in all transparency, we've had some capacity-related issues over the last year. Now we're out of the woods on that, and I'll explain. I kind of hinted at that, why we ran into that. That is, this explosive growth of doubling year over year caught some of our, forecasters off guard. I've always been one of the voices of saying we shouldn't be optimizing so close to the line when it's going to impact customer business if we get it wrong. And we don't really have enough learning at this point to really do accurate forecasting of what this is going to look like. So let's err on the side of having too much, because more than likely it's just a matter of time. It's like whether you're not utilizing those servers for 1 month or 2 months, really, is kind of what it boils down to. And of course, in the starting of the business, that can be a significant percentage of the business. But in the big picture of things, when you talk about the customers that get annoyed because you've run out and say, wait a minute, I don't buy that you're this whole cloud value proposition you told us, don't worry about it. We're Elastic, hyperscale, virtual, you can use as much as you want whenever you want it. We violated that promise to them, and now they're going to be, we're going to lose some trust. And so we've gotten to the point where now we are operating under that mentality of overbuild for the forecast, because we can't afford to screw it up. And so we believe that we're out of the woods on this, given these kinds of doubling year over year kind of forecast that we're going to see. Hopefully we're not going to cut. And another aspect of it too is that we've gotten a lot more efficient about responding to demand. So back in the early days of Azure, when we wanted to build out a region with a new data center and get those servers, provision it, and then run out of servers and have to buy new servers, we were talking like 6 month lead times from, we're going to need servers, more servers. Let's 6 months ahead of time go start that exercise of getting those servers ordered, provisioned on taken off the loading docks, wired up, tested, and then turned on and made available publicly. That time has compressed, and it keeps compressing down so that we can respond really quickly to any change in demand in a particular area and get ahead of it. So combination of those two things, being a little bit worried about that buffer, that's that expansion buffer, because as we get bigger, that becomes less and less of a significant part of the overall cogs of the service, plus getting really efficient at, hey, because if you think about it, if we had what we call it's a signal to live, that's the measure that we use, a signal that there's going to be demand to that capacity for the demand being live. If that was zero, we would never run out of capacity. But that's going to always be some finite number. The smaller it is, the easier it is for us to respond and not run out of capacity.
So let's kind of jump off that, because what that means is for a few days in a particular region, storage was the bottleneck, okay? And I love the point you made about, hey, I think it's roughly a $20 billion industry cloud now, and you're saying IT is at trillions, which means there's a lot of growth potential. Great. That means we're talking about how do you feed it. What do you think would be the bottlenecks? I mean, is there a point where there's just some bottleneck that the speed of light is getting in the way? You know what I'm saying? There's some physical constraint, or maybe HP can only make servers so quickly.
Well, around how big it is today. So, I mean, if you
no,
think
no,
of...
No, 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 no. I'm saying, so you guys are growing, and you're thinking about how you're growing. And is there some binding constraint? Could be just a temporary bottleneck, or it's just simply a binding constraint that we can't support more than X computers on the planet. There's only much silicon. Is there something like that?
I don't think we're anywhere close to that. If you take a look at just how many servers are sitting there on-prem in IT, and you talk about those servers shifting into a public cloud, we're far from that amount of servers in the public cloud. So right there, that kind of gives you an idea for just how much the planet is supporting today that could all be in public cloud. And I think that we can go up multiple times that size without running into any fundamental constraint, like, oh, we've run out of zirconium on the planet or something.
Yeah, exactly right.
Element.
If you think about it, I mean, there are some rare earths that are used in particular kinds of circuits, and, the U.S. doesn't control a lot of that. Yeah. I mean, other countries control. It's not an unreasonable thing. But what about bandwidth? What about electricity? What about, is there... What's the first one we hit, if indeed we hit?
I haven't really thought about it because we're a ways ahead of it.
This is science fiction. Yeah. So the answer is I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah. I think, you know, when it comes to energy, this is one of the areas where we are want to make sure that we don't, you know, cause a drain on energy. And so I think we just announced about three weeks ago or something, a commitment to having 50% of our energy be for our data centers be renewable by the year 20. I think it's the 2020. Don't quote me on that. It's somewhere, you know, in the next few years, we'll hit 50% renewable energy. We've got lots of examples of renewable data centers today, like our data centers in Quincy, which, by the way, there was an article 2 days ago where you can go read about the Quincy data center and the evolution of our data center architectures that's online. If you go follow me on Twitter, go look at the feed, and I tweeted out a link to this article. But that is data centers, and there's other companies in that same place, all fed by the Columbia River, that power there. So it's 100% renewable energy in that case.
Okay. Because it's IT pros talking to the cloud guy, I'm going to always ask you this question. What's on our things to do list for the next year? If I'm an IT pro, I want to still be an IT pro, still want to have my job, et cetera. Can you tell me 3 things that I really need to get a little smart on?
We talked about containers. That is one thing to get smart on, because your containers are going to be coming at you. And I think one of the things that we didn't really hit on is this: containers are useful for IT pros as well as developers. And developers use containers because as they create their application, they describe the components and build them up as container images. But for IT pros, and of course you're going to be, as an IT pro, potentially managing the infrastructure underneath those containers, whether it's a Mesos cluster or that you're managing yourself, or a Cloud Foundry deployment that you're managing yourself. But IT pros also can take advantage of containers directly. And that is, you talk about lift and shift. Take that application that you've got, your website or whatever, you want to lift and shift that into the cloud. Well, go put it in a container. And once it's in a container.
Isn't that something I need a dev to do, though?
No, an IT pro can take an existing type of application like that you've got running. As long as you can install it, you can install it into a container.
This is classic ASP, so I don't think that's going to go in a container really well.
Maybe it could. I mean,
That's an interesting thought. It's an interesting thought. Okay, so we should learn containers. Can you give me some ideas of what we should be looking at? Is it possible to play with one? Is there an MSDN article that says, here, create this container, set it up, run it? Is there a walkthrough somewhere?
Yeah, there's walkthroughs all over the place on this. And of course, you don't have Server 2016. You can spin one up in Azure today. Go spin up a Server 2016 image and then go and launch containers into it. You can have it be playing with containers in literally a few minutes.
And the kind of tasks we want to know are what? How to start them, how to stop them, how to delete them, how to install them, how to monitor them?
How to configure them. Take a look at if your company is going to be using containers, they're almost certainly going to be using an orchestration technology. I mentioned a few of them. So go become familiar with that and start playing with what does it look like to go create a multi-container application on top of one of these things. So Mesos, for example, or Docker Swarm has this language, it's a declarative model called Compose, where you can describe the different parts of your application as different containers and specify the network configuration for them. Go play with one of those and create a containerized application on Docker Swarm.
So containers, anything else?
So containers.
What's new stuff we should be looking at, or things we should know about? New challenges, anything like that?
I think we've talked about this before. I think from an IT pro's perspective,
I'm assuming the answer is different every year.
It is, but some of the answers are kind of constant, because if you're talking about you're starting this journey to Azure and you want to understand how to help your organization and how to, you know, I think it's fundamentally a role of IT to be the governors for the organization, right? To make sure that as the developers and business units are going and creating applications, they're not putting the business at risk, either from a cost perspective or from a security perspective. And so this is where understanding network security, how you can connect your applications in the cloud back to on-premises in a secure way, how you isolate them in a secure way in the cloud so that they're not exposed to outside attacks, and then cost management and the management policies that are possible. So, and this is a place where you're going to see this as the cloud gets more evolved, you're going to see more and more solutions from us, but there's also partner ecosystem there that's got solutions where we don't have them for. How much is this costing me? And what kind of tools can I put in place to control those costs? It's been a fascinating journey for me to work closely with Microsoft IT who has been on this cloud journey since I started in Azure, when Steve Ballmer told them, you are going to the cloud. And they reluctantly at the time said, well, why us? And and so they've been one of these where they didn't get a choice in the, you know, let's evaluate, is the cloud right for us? You know, like everybody else is doing. Right. They were just forced to do it. But they were, at the same time, held accountable for reducing costs as they did it. And so this has forced them to say, what do I need to do to keep Microsoft secure, Microsoft corporate assets secure? How do I put in place, you know, I've got this web application firewall on premises. What do I do with that in the cloud? Or I've got this network load balancer. What's the corresponding thing in the cloud, and how do I manage that, and how do I look at the flows that are going through that from a security perspective and from a reliability perspective? If I get a call from one of my customers and they tell me that the application is dropping packets, what do I do about that? So this is where IT, basically I talked about this with you, I view it as IT as a service, and more I see IT within companies being the, we're going to go create the cloud, basically a cloud delivery platform for my company, so that these business units aren't going making it up on their own. I can say, oh, you want to use the cloud? Here, go use these templates. These policies are in place. They're flowing from AAD, so we can make sure that you're doing it the right way. And we've got these costing systems looking at you. We're tracking you in the system so we can help you control the cost of your application. We can help you right-size your virtual machines.
Basically what you're saying is, if IT gets out in front with cloud services, you won't have a situation where you turn around in 3 years and there's 15 different shadow IT things
exactly. In
different clouds and they can't be managed.
And the costs have just blown up.
Exactly, right, exactly. So that sounds like that's a good thing to put on things to do list. We got a little time left, and we've probably engendered a lot of questions in people's minds. Do you mind if we take some from the crowd? Does anybody have a question? Please go to the mic if you have a question for Dr. Rasinovich. Really, it was that easy? Okay, sorry. Hang on. Can we get that mic live, please? There we go.
Okay.
State your name.
My name is Fritz. I'm from Austria, and we greatly use the Azure platform, and we have a big bunch of ASM machines. And before you explained that the only way to migrate them is like to basically recreate them with the VHDs. But I saw and I heard some, there's another way to do this automatically. Like with a migration path that unless you have gateways and stuff in place, it doesn't work at the moment. But there is definitely another way to do this, like to benefit from the ARM infrastructure.
So other way to migrate the machine, like with Azure Site Recovery, migrate a virtual machine?
Not this. There is when you have a VNet with virtual machines and stuff inside, you could trigger a command that prepares them to be moved to ARM.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's basically underneath the hood, that's what's happening. It's taking the disk and then rehydrating that virtual machine.
Okay, but the thing is, and I think it was mentioned, or not mentioned, that it's important that this can be done automatically.
Yeah. It's an automatic.
Because when you have hundreds of machines, it's a little.
There's an automated way to do it. Yeah, okay. You're right.
Good. Yeah, other question. Over there. By the way, C1 is far away from everything, which is I know why people leave in early. Please don't forget to do an evaluation. We really, really appreciate you guys coming out. I hope this was useful, and I hope you come back next year when we do it, okay? So otherwise, we're taking questions, though. Yes.
So as cloud adoption grows, do you see the cost coming down for like Azure and cloud services?
I couldn't hear the question.
Cloud services grow, do you see the cost coming down for Azure and cloud services?
With greater scale, is Azure going to get cheaper?
I think that we'll always try to pass on cost reductions to customers as the service gets more scalable, more.
Actually,
and costs of hardware continue to drop too.
You've
seen we've had, I don't know how many cost reductions over the past couple of years.
And every time Amazon cuts costs, they do it too. So you just get Amazon cut costs and Azure will get cheaper.
Yeah.
Just
Hi, this might not be the right venue, but we have these servers on-prem with these enormous LUNs, like 18 terabyte, 25 terabyte, with full you know, NTFS permissions and cackles and ACLs and all that stuff. We'd love to move these up, or at least partially move them up and get the storage, but when you have to take and create a dozen or 16, whatever it is, 1 terabyte LUNs and span them in the OS, which was like the scariest thing back in NT4.
Yeah.
What's the future of full permissions, large storage in Azure, like full NTFS permissions with full, you know, ACLs and everything?
Full-blown migrating a 25 terabyte
just
volume.
Just huge LUNs.
Yeah.
For one machine, not taking it.
So you're going to see the
more and more and more machines.
You're going to see the support for larger and larger disks, you know, continue. So you'll see in the next, I can't talk about timelines, but you're going to see support for larger and larger disks show up. And now you're also going to see new ways to ingress data that are going to make it a lot more efficient where you're not
with,
just...
With full permissions, like
yep.
full ADFS?
Yep.
And is it going to be like, what's the current largest? Is it still 1 terabyte?
I think it's still 1 terabyte, yeah.
See, that's just crazy, but anyway,
yeah.
Thanks.
We hear you.
You guys are so behind the times. Where's those exabyte volumes?
Hi, my name's Ryan. I'm a developer. And you mentioned vendor lock-in earlier, and I guess one of the things that I've been trying to push our organization to do more is to do more PaaS, because there's a lot of cost and operational benefits to going that way. But they brought up vendor lock-in quite a few times, and I guess this isn't as much a question as it is a comment. I don't worry about it quite as much as others, because to me, my ASP.NET application will run in a PaaS instance in Azure just as easily as it will in AWS. But there are definitely software artifacts that are a little more tied into Azure and are going to probably tie you in more. So I don't know if that's your general feelings on it, too. It's like when it comes to locking it, it's almost like it kind of depends situation.
Yeah, it does depend. And I think if you're talking about just the compute, and whether you're using Beanstalk or app service, web apps,
right.
Yeah, you're going to be pretty portable. But it's, I think when I talk about PaaS, it's like, am I taking advantage of Azure Database? Am I taking advantage of Azure Data Lake? Am I taking advantage of Azure Machine Learning as part of? And so as I start to use those higher level PaaSes, my application becomes more tied. Am I using Event Hubs and Stream Analytics? Those things become less portable, but the challenge is for an organization that says, I'm not going to use that stuff, is that they've got to build it all themselves and deliver it, and so they're going to be much less efficient and much slower at delivering capabilities to their company than we will as a public cloud provider. And so they're basically crippling themselves, and that'd be fine if you didn't have any competitors. The problem is you've got competitors that are saying, you know what, we're going to deal with a little vendor lock-in because we get this agility and this efficiency, and so they're going to be coming out to market faster with more features for their applications and services for their customers than you will be able to. So I think ultimately any company that is saying, I'm staying vendor neutral, I'm not stay away from PaaS, is going to be forced into it just to be competitive.
Cool. Thanks.
Okay, somebody over there.
Hey, but yeah, we just now started to implement cloud not too long ago, and I wanted to get your take on many discussions that we have about lift and shift as opposed to re-architecturing and migrating. Do you prefer, hey, let's just lift and shift and then work about re-architecting, just get a presence in the cloud, or should we take this extra time planning and having other third-party
yeah.
vendors coming out?
That's a really great question. So it's really, as an organization moving to the cloud, do I lift and shift and just get up there right now, or do I say I'm going to go re-architect these apps and modernize them before I move them? And I've seen companies take both approaches. I would recommend against lifting and shifting unless you were going to at least go and do a cost optimization right-sizing of those workloads into virtual machines, and then also take advantage of the elasticity of the cloud for those virtual machines. So one of the easiest things, and MSIT has gone through this too, lifted and shifted an application. It's one of those applications that's not used after 5, 6 p.m. when everybody goes home. So they have this thing called Grim Reaper that sits and shuts down those things when nobody's using them. It actually sends a warning, hey, we're about to shut down your virtual machine. And that has saved them tens of millions of dollars a month in Azure costs just by having that service in place that is going and taking advantage of elasticity. So, and in fact, it can cost you more than it did on premises if you just are lifting and shifting and letting the thing operate the same way as it did on premises.
Let me tell some, yeah. some from my experience. In my case, it was fairly easy to just move the VHDs up and just try it. You know, it wasn't that terribly hard to make the thing happen. And that, you know, by running it a few days, I get an idea of what the cost was. Also, as Mark said, flip a switch, one line PowerShell command, and the thing gets 5 more CPUs. Let's try that. I mean, really, it didn't take me more than, once it was up there, 45 minutes to get the thing running and be happy with it. So ultimately, if you've got the time to do the planning, do it. But if you're in a spot, I don't really think you can often go wrong by just do the lift and shift, and while you got it working, then you can look at, you know, what can we do to make this run better. So, yeah.
First, are you going to have a book signing?
What's that?
Are you going to have a book signing?
Yes, book signing is at what time, Aaron? What? 2:30. Book signing is at 2:30.
And Aaron paid me to ask.
Yeah.
John McGlinchey, yeah. I've worked with.
Yeah, so by the way, book signing, that's going to be at the bookstore, and it includes my novels as well as Windows Internals and SysInternals, right. The current edition, as well as you can pre-order there the next edition of Troubleshooting with the Windows SysInternals Tools, which comes out in October. 25% discount, and you get a signed card you can paste into the front with that Aaron and I will sign for you, so it's you
yeah,
can pre-sign
as I said,
it.
Aaron paid me, yeah. So. John McGlinchey, I've crossed paths with both of you for over the past 20 years, here and there, when I worked at Microsoft a few times.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm now working in the legal industry, a very large multinational global law firm, and one of our problems is that a perception of insecurity in the cloud. And we have major clients that will not let us put a document outside of our infrastructure. Mm-hmm. We have to prove that it's there, prove that it's secure. For lots of different reasons. I'd love to talk to you on the side about it. But what can you, Microsoft, or the industry do to overcome that perception, not reality,
yep.
I understand it's not reality.
Sounds like a job for Azure
perception of insecurity when we put something up there rather than on our own.
So it's interesting that you're saying that because I think that in the last 12 months I've seen a shift from the cloud is insecure, less secure, to actually the cloud is more secure. In fact, we've seen, just as an example of this, the global systemically important financial institutions, the G-SIFIs, too big to fail banks, we had 0 of them signed up to use Azure at the beginning of the year. 75% of them are signed up and using Azure at this point.
Those are the clients I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we are, in fact, I'm flying up to talk to one of them tomorrow about the, not the bulk of their applications, but they're actually looking at, hey, if we move our trading systems into Azure, what do we need for security?
That's
so it's one of those things where the vast majority, they're like, yeah, more secure than what we do it. It's this last little piece we've got some concerns over. And so,
we're going to be seeing guidelines around being able to, for us to be able to prove to those globals that we are following this guidance from, say, Microsoft on being able to use a secure document management system that's a bit cloud-based.
Wait, sorry.
So, you know, most of our business is about securing documents,
yep.
You know, their documents in our system. So I'm looking, you know, is there, after you've done those discussions, will there be some guidance around that?
Well, so I'm down in the infrastructure parts of the discussion.
Yep.
What you're talking about is like O365 and Azure Rights Management, or RMS services, around document protection and DLP, and that's...
Yes.
Discussion that I typically don't get into is focused on the platform itself.
Okay.
Also, to address your question, when are people going to stop worrying about the cloud?
Yeah, that's right. IDG
does a very nice survey. In general, most web surveys are garbage. But IDG, I used to do this for a living, you know, designing and analyzing this stuff. And I think they do the best. In their November survey of 2014, they said that 56% of the people they surveyed said real problems with security in the cloud. In 2015, 41%. That is an incredibly large, I don't think the cloud got that much better in 1 year. So it may just be that perceptions have changed. So that's one data point. And we have 3/4 of a minute, Dr. Rasinovich. Can you
yeah.
do one more real quick?
Yep.
Hi.
I don't know whose turn it is.
So
over there.
3 weeks ago, thereabouts, there was a major service outage in the North and West Europe regions. And then about 2 weeks ago, there was another one, of a slightly different nature. So best practice says that you design your applications to be resilient to sort of single instance failure. Microsoft pair regions to kind of protect against a similar thing. So if you've designed...
Didn't catch that last part.
Sorry, so Microsoft pair Azure regions to protect against or to provide resiliency in that sort of event. But if you've designed your application infrastructure to take advantage of the paired regions, and then a fault develops in both regions simultaneously, should we be doing something else?
So this question's around a service outage we had that impacted a couple regions in Europe, and then another one that we had recently that impacted another couple. Both of those were network related, so one was a DNS DOS problem, and the other one that we didn't respond to quickly enough, and the other one was a network misconfiguration issue that so caused routes to screw up for multiple regions. And the bottom line is that our, you know, it's going to sound worn maybe, but we take each one of these and we learn how to prevent this thing from happening again. And this is just our goal, and we've instituted something called safe deployment policy to try to hold to that promise that we're not going to impact more than one region at a time. And that has been a big focus of ours ever since the November 2014 storage outage that you might have heard of. You can go see me talking on Channel 9 about it, and that resulted from us pushing out what we thought was an innocuous change across multiple regions at the same time that end up causing storage stamps to fail. That learning has resulted in us putting in this process and policy and tooling to have safe rollout for all of our services to try to guarantee that promise of those DR pairs there should fail independently of each other. So bottom line is we don't want you to re-architect.
Bottom line is we're out of time.
But yeah.
Dr. Sinovich, thank you so much. And by the way, hang on, we're not done. In a few months, the good doctor is turning 50. So indeed. Thanks. So if he's not quite as quick next time, you'll know why. So thank you very much. Please do an evaluation. And remember always to use this knowledge for good and not for evil. Thank you for your time. Thank you.